Let me know. Just a guess.
All right. First order of business is the approval of the previous meeting.
Lunch is here.
Right.
And I suggest we
reconvene.
Do your regulations after lunch?
Yeah, if your regulations after lunch, let's have to gather back to conservation to read his.
I'd like to reopen the conservation committee and would like to now propose that we recess for executive session. Therefore, I'd like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code referred to as the Open Meetings Act, the executive session will be held this time for the purpose of deliberations of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. And, Gene, anything else? That's it. It says and. All right. Okay. We are now reconvening the public session. Okay, at this time we will reconvene the session of the Conservation Committee. Is any business to be brought before this committee, Mr. Cook? Nothing further? Okay. This committee has completed its business. We'll move on to the new infrastructure. We'll move on to regulations.
All right. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes. Do we have a motion for approval?
I move. Second.
Moved by Brown, second by Ramos. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. And committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the 19th round of the Commercial Bay and Bait Strip buyback, CPWD signed contracts for 142 licenses, 66 bay licenses, and 76 bait licenses. From the 179 applications, at a cost of $1.1 million. An additional 30 licenses were purchased with $130,000 from the Coastal Conservation Association. So our buyback program proceeds and is going well. FYI, and hope that some of you will be able to attend the 52nd Texas Game Warden Academy, which is currently composed of 23 cadets. We started with 25 and had a couple drop out. We'll graduate on May 18th, 2007, here in Austin. Site, time, and location to be determined, and we will advise you so. Just an FYI, kind of in this group of 23 of our cadets, we are also training two cadets from Mexico who are going to take back this law enforcement conservation game warden training back to Mexico, back to Nuevo León, and implement a program there very similar to our program. So we think that's a great partnership, work well together with them, and they are good cadets, good students, and we're enjoying having them. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Committee item number two, potential changes to migratory bird proclamation, permission to publish. Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. My name is Vernon Bevel, and I'm Program Director for Small Game and Habitat Assessment Program. What I'm bringing to you today is kind of a preview of the migratory bird regulations that we anticipate that will be moving forward over the next several months between our flyway councils and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. For morning doves, the calendar changes are shown on this map. We don't anticipate any other major changes in mourning doves at this time, although there's a lot more background noise about mourning doves today than there has been, so down the road there may be some discussions of change. As far as the special white-winged dove area, we will be entering the third year of our experiment on the expansion of the special white-winged area. And at the end of this third year, we will be compiling an evaluation of harvest parameters that we found to be the case with that expansion. And, of course, one of the interest areas of the Fish and Wildlife Service was that we didn't put any additional pressure on mourning dove. That was their concern. And so we will be finishing up that experimental three-year period this fall and be providing him a report about this time next spring. And that report will determine whether or not we're able to continue that or make some other modification. For teal season, the surveys for waterfowl, all waterfowl, begin in May on the Canadian breeding grounds, and so we anticipate that the teal population should be above the threshold for a 16-day season, but you never know until they get up there and fly those survey transects. But if it is a 16-day season, we would recommend from the 15th of September to the 30th. However, if it's a 9-day season, it would be, we recommend the 22nd to the 30th. And it is a commission policy of longstanding that we either take the last three full weekends or the last two full weekends. Other changes in webbed species are shown on this slide. We try to match up these webbed species and our waterfowl seasons to the greatest extent we can, so that if people are out hunting and they have an opportunity to take some of these other species, it's value added to that experience for them. We think we will have another liberal season. Conditions in Canada are really good, and some of the traditional breeding grounds. Conditions, however, in the northern U.S. are spotty, although they have been getting some precipitation lately. I know going through most of the winter, I was getting reports from my counterparts in the Dakotas and Montana that their breeding areas were in pretty poor shape because of drought in that part of the world. But if we get what we anticipate, we'd be looking at an 89-day regular duck season in the High Plain Mallard Management Unit, the red area, plus the two extra days for the youth weekend. And for the north and south zone, we have been running the seasons concurrent in the north and south zones with the longer seasons. And the reason for having the zone is if we get into a situation where we have much shorter seasons, like the 39-day season we had back in the early 90s, then the zone configuration makes a lot more sense for trying to stratify the season to take the best advantage of when ducks are north or south. The bag limits, we are, as you recall, one of the harvest states that has the aggregate bag, the Hunter Choice bag, and this will be the second year of the Hunter Choice experiment. At the Flyway Council meeting, all the 500 choice bag states all reported that they had very little negative comment on the Hunter Choice option, that it seemed to work well and work the way it should for everybody. And there is a lot of concern for the model duck. At the Fish and Wildlife Service level, we are involved with some work with the service on developing a much tighter breeding population survey that will go into effect officially a year from now in April. And hopefully that will give us some better population data from which we can make more informed decisions about management needs. The other species of concern is scalp, and there's some concern that we may be looking at some reductions on scalp harvest this year. But that's in that negotiation state right now. We don't know how that'll come out. This is the proposal for the eastern goose zone. We break that out into the light goose, the Canada goose, and the white-fronted goose season, because those three species are managed under separate population management models, and therefore the difference. However, in the western goose zone, since we ratcheted down to only one white front, we manage these the season there as a light goose or dark goose season. And at the end of the dark goose season, we anticipate being able to implement the light goose conservation order once again. This is the season scenario for Sandhill Crane. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. We are recommending we move forward to publish these in the Texas Register, and we will come back through the for the early season. Mr. Cook will make the decision because it's between commission meetings, and in the late season, decisions will be to the charge of the commission.
Any questions?
Just for the record, Vernon, would you please go over the situation of the late season, and particularly the possibility of shifting days away from the front end of the south zone point of and adding it to the...
Let me run back to that slide.
Yes, sir.
And also, again, kind of brief the commission on the timing of that cycle.
The process for migratory birds started in February with a briefing of the Service Regulations Committee in early February. Then we moved forward to our technical committee's meeting in early March and preparing a set of recommendations that come to the Flyway Council, our Flyway Councils, all four Flyway Councils, and then about 2 weeks ago at the North American. We then passed on those recommendations and moved them forward to Fish and Wildlife Service. So the processes for change in migratory bird regulations are already well underway. And with regard to the special white wing season, by having those 4 days, we lose 4 days in the rest of the south zone. The special white wing area has 4 days given to them earlier in those first 2 weekends in September. So those 4 days are taken out of the end of the season in the south zone. That doesn't mean that we couldn't buy 4 days from the first split and put them at the end of the split, because we do continue to hear comments from some south zone hunters, because they have does pile up in the south zone as they winter there, that they like that later hunting opportunity. And of course, the rest of the south zone, except for the special white wing area, get a later season.
And tie that in again, if you can, just so we have an understanding of this, how this zone boundary was established to the study, the 3-year study that's being conducted, and the relevance of that.
I don't have a pointer, but if you look at the area along I-35 that angled up to the south end of San Antonio where it intersects 1604, that is primarily the expansion area in this experimental expansion that we're involved in. And the reason for that is that we've just had a huge influx of white wings. And you can start hunting white wings north of Highway 90 on September the 1st, because that's in the central zone. And then south of Highway 90 had been in the south zone. And we had a lot of interest out of our sportsmen along Highway 90 of being able to hunt white wings on both sides of the highway. And so we were able to gain some latitude from the service to expand the special white wing area to encompass that part of the south zone.
Is that how these 2 weekend dates originated?
The 2 weekend dates have always been part of the special white wing season. We were given the latitude with Fish and Wildlife Service to hunt white wings the first 2 weekends in September.
It used to be, Mark, just down along the river. And, you know, to make things simple, what we did was we moved the zone to where the white wings were.
Right.
and before that.
And in doing so, we did have, in the old white wing season configuration, the latitude to shoot up to 5 mourning doves. We had to concede to a 4 mourning dove bag limit over the Fish and Wildlife Service concern for the mourning dove population in general. And part of this evaluation is to determine what, if any, impact this expansion has had on increasing the harvest of mourning doves significantly in that area, so that we'll be giving them the report on that next spring.
Bernie, you just tell them just a little bit about the late fledgling issue on mourning doves and
yes,
why we weren't able to move that line.
Back in the '60s, this department did extensive nestronology studies on doves, and determined that a significant percentage of our mourning dove population actually leave the nest after September the 1st. And it was a significant enough percent that that we all collectively, us and Fish and Wildlife Service, felt that, that opening mourning dove season in the South Zone early would be a detriment to the breeding population in the South Zone. Even so, the South Zone is one of the breeding populations in Texas that is somewhat declining, even with the later opening of the normal South Zone season. So, but we don't think that's we don't think that is a hunting issue at all.
Vernon, did the council, the feds ever going to consider the being able to trade? You're talking about trading days forward in early part. In the back, it's, you've got a limited number you've got to allocate between the two. There are a lot of people in South Texas, obviously, that enjoy better shooting in the second split. Are they ever going to consider, one, increasing the number of days so that we could add to the winter? Or, you know, years ago we talked about the half day. Mm-hmm. They don't give us any credit if we went to half day.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe revisiting that issue, you know, the issue about half day, there's no reason to go from full day to half day right now because we don't get any credit for it.
I think that choice is ours, Mr. Chairman, and that choice would be taking our first split and moving days out of the end of our first split into the end of the second split. We get 70 days in the South Zone. We lose four of those days to the special white wing season. So then we split the regular South Zone twice. We opened it up on the Friday nearest the 20th of September, unless September the 20th falls on Saturday, and then we open it on Saturday. So then we run that first split, which we're proposing here to run it from the 21st to the 11th of November, and then the second split, running it from the 26th of December to the 8th. Of January, which in the rest of the South Zone goes to the 11th. I believe it's the 11th of January. Well. So if you wanted to make the rest of the South Zone, the late South Zone season match up across the board, you would have to take days out of the first split to do that.
You'd have to take them out of the first split.
Yes, you'd have to take them out of the 21st to the 11th.
You couldn't begin the South Zone on December the 30th and end it on January.
Well, you
16th.
Could certainly do that, but the reason we were doing it the way we have been doing it is to accommodate kids that are out of school during Christmas holiday.
The idea was to do. I remember. Well, it was Chairman Armstrong. Working on that. I mean, that's the idea, John, is that's when kids are out of school.
Yeah.
Between Christmas and New Year. So you don't want to push back.
I understand that.
December 23rd.
It's interesting in that his...
Then I talked to my son about that.
It was a lot of race three. I know about that.
The cheapest days in terms of opportunity and bag to give up in any of the zones are the last few days of the first split. You lose less in terms of hunting activity and harvest opportunity giving up the last 4 days of the first split as you would any other time. And in the South Zone, because it is a wintering zone, doves tend to stack up in the South Zone in December, January. Hard to hunt them a lot of times in the South Zone because there's not enough hunting pressure that put on them that they can just pick up and after the first volley and fly to another field, and you don't have access to that field, so it's over.
Are you saying that there's a possibility that we could take 4 days off of November the 11th, end it on November 11th, and add it to January the 12th?
You would end on a weekday, but you could end November the 8th, 7th, rather, and add those to the end of the to the January period and in the special white wing zone area at the same time the regular.
You're talking about that green zone?
The red zone. Yeah. Red zone.
Oh, we're back to that other deal.
You wouldn't add any additional days on the normal schedule. Make the white wing zone and the south zone match.
Match.
The winter season match up.
Mr. Chairman, take that early opportunity away.
Is there any possibility that the red zone in the special white wing dove area, is there any possibility that that zone could be expanded to include more area of South Texas?
You mean to the east?
To the east.
Well, then we talked about that, didn't we? First time, and they said they didn't have the research to
The issue there is I really believe we would only reconfirm with about $600,000 to $800,000 worth of expenditure on new research what was determined in the 1960s that the fledging rate on mourning doves is so significant in the South Zone that that they would not allow us to expand. So I think that we would only spend money to reconfirm what we already know, and when I think there are other issues coming down the pike on doves that we would be better off saving that money to do research on. So that's my judgment.
If we're inclined to go past the January the 8th date, being sensitive to the youth, it would seem to me we'd be better off moving it before the 26th because they generally get out of college and school before Christmas, so rather than pack on the tail end, I think it'd be smarter to pack it on the earlier. In other words,
the comment we get from dove hunters in the South Zone is later is better. And in fact, Texas is the only state in the country that can actually go in our late split on dove to the 25th of January.
Right.
So we have.
Can't we take days from the September 21st and November 11th and pack them before Christmas? Because over the Christmas break is when...
You can.
I think it would expose more youth to that season than packing on past January the 8th. I'm thinking about going to the 21st or 22nd of December. That's what I was thinking.
We have an old survey that we did to get to this season structure we now have,
that was in the 90s?
Late 90s. And I could certainly pull that old research out and look and see what the opinion survey told us at that time about the interest of the hunters.
I'd venture to say that most of the people that responded to that survey were over 20 years of age.
Probably so.
It affects them. They might go later, better, because they're
sure.
Better. Mm. Bernie made a comment about the South Zone morning dove population dropping. Did I understand that?
Yes.
You said you didn't think it's hunting pressure.
It's not hunting pressure.
What, can I ask your opinion at this point?
Coastal Bermuda Pack.
Yeah. Mm. How about white wing pressure? Does that affect?
There's some empirical evidence that and it's mostly in the city environment where colonies of white wings establish and expand that the prevalence of mourning doves begins to drop off, and I see that right in my own neighborhood where I live, but that's an empirical observation. We're working right now to expand our urban area surveys of mourning doves because they're exploding all over the state of Texas.
Yeah, I just said we're in Kingsville. We have a lease down there, and it has been open. We're seeing just in the last 5 years, the white wings dramatically increasing.
We've got them 50 miles north of Abilene.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're definitely very aggressive.
We have a breeding population in Amarillo.
Bernie, just so this question can go on the record, opening the north zone on August the 15th is all my constituents keep asking me to do is in violation of the international treaty.
Yes, sir.
Just want to make sure that question.
You're like your constituent, right?
You can take that, though, if you really work.
Yeah, the rest of your life.
Because you're relatively young.
Yeah. You can't get that done, Commissioner.
So is there a desire at this point to look into this?
I would like to see staff look at maybe taking some days from that first split, like you say, and opening the season maybe the 21st of December or Friday, right when the youth are getting out of school and stuff. I think we just give them an extra 3 or 4 days.
You're talking about maybe, the first 10 or 11 days of November?
Yes.
In other words, probably in the top zone.
Let's say you took 5 days from November the 11th or pushed September 21st. I'm indifferent to whatever would work there.
As we've been sitting here, I've been trying to resurrect in my brain the discussion of that time. And one of you back then said something to the effect that Mama has the kids on the first 4 or 5 days that they first get out of school before Christmas, and then Daddy gets them after Christmas. So
it wasn't me. The nice kids head to the woods and eat it.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's just a thought.
It wasn't me because neither of us have any kids.
We can certainly look back and see and maybe look at proposing it both ways and see what seems to fit with the
company. If I understood what you said, I think one of the important issues here that I believe you mentioned was that I think the preference would be from the feds and everybody involved that we stay with what we have and finish this 3-year
study. As far as the zone line goes, we can't change the zone line without going back through a federal process.
And to have the continuity of the data, I suspect that.
Absolutely.
As far as looking at these opportunities, I think, gentlemen, through the years, as Mr. Bevel and other folks here, we've tried a lot of things. Some of them have worked well. Some of them have, kind of indifferent. And we're certainly willing within the framework that we've got to work with to look at every opportunity. And it's y'all's pleasure.
So, should we look at that, Donato, in the...
It's up to the commission. I don't think it would hurt to look into it. I don't know if it would be that significant from a data standpoint, other than the fact that you're creating some opportunities for the youth, which, I think we need to continue to push that.
Are you in the second year of the 3 year?
We're headed to the third year. We've done 2 years now.
I'm glad to see that in spite of new leadership in the regulations committee, these things still take just as long.
We're just getting started.
You get to ask all your questions.
So are we looking for adjustment to that prior to permission to publish, or what do we?
We have your guidance, I think, okay. and we will go back and craft the Texas Register in a way that we can discuss that.
Are you
going
to help here?
if it's going to be rated, I don't want to push it. I just think it's something we ought to look at. Maybe not this year, maybe too late, but
why don't we take a look at taking a good look at that study, and we're going to have other data that we can draw from and look at it in the next cycle.
Sure.
But yeah. That would be my suggestion. But I'd like to
do it 3 years.
Yes.
And also put it off for another year, but look at expanding somehow that east of 1017.
Take a good look at that dividing line, yes.
Southeasterly down to
as well as some accommodation dates for increased opportunity. Okay. Any other discussion or questions?
Thank you, Vernon.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions or discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 3, proposed changes to non-game permit program. Permission to publish, Matt Wagner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. I'd like to discuss with you today some proposed changes to our non-game permit program. Just to remind you, we have two types of non-game permits. We have a collector's permit required for those possessing more than 25 specimens and wishing to sell. We have both a resident and non-resident permit. And then dealers, for those requiring or wishing to purchase and then resell. So just to clarify, the collectors can only sell to dealers. The dealers are then permitted separately and required to report annually to us. Over the last several months, we've been looking at the data reported to us, and it's very clear to us that there's a growing demand for turtle meat to China and other foreign markets. Looking at the information over the last 3 years, we see an average of over 94,000 turtles per year collected or purchased by at least 50 dealers in the state, and then most of these are exported to overseas markets. The regulation in other states is essentially a little tighter than Texas, although our reports are helping us determine that, but there is increased pressure coming from out-of-state collectors and a huge growing demand for turtle meat. Some of the species involved in the turtle trade are box turtles. These are mostly collected for pets, diamondback terrapin, and then freshwater turtles, including map turtles, soft shells, the common snapping turtle, and other species as well. Now, at present, we've been reviewing the literature, and at least a dozen scientific publications indicate that the commercial harvest of wild turtle populations is essentially not sustainable. At some point, you will deplete the population. In June of 06, map turtles, of which we have four subspecies of map turtles in the state, were listed under CITES. This is a federal tracking system. They're in Appendix 3, actually, which is just an information reporting system where the turtles originated and if they are legally harvested from those states. Some southeastern states have actually prohibited the commercial collection of wild turtles, and most states are more restrictive than Texas. Our monitoring is being improved and expanded, though, so we are tightening up on the reporting. We've had numerous meetings with the various interest groups, including seven herpetological societies. We had a non-game dealer meeting here in Austin. We've had approximately 300 participants total provide input to us. There is a very wide range of interests, but everyone agrees that sustainability is the goal. Now, our key recommendations to you today for consideration would be to create a whitelist. All non-game on a proposed whitelist would be allowed to be commercially collected and reported to us. Any species not on that whitelist would then be prohibited from commercial collection. Annual reporting would be required for collection, purchase, and sale of species on the whitelist. At the same time, we would prohibit the commercial collection and sale of all turtles except red-eared slider. And this is due to the natural history of turtles, including the delayed maturity. Many of these turtles don't reach maturity to at least 6 years of age. The dependence of the population on adult survivorship, which is key. High mortality of the young. Restricted range from a lot of these turtles. And then the loss of natural habitat, wetlands, and other important water features. All of these factors contribute to this vulnerability to overcollecting. Now, red-eared sliders are a little different in that they really are opportunists in the turtle world. We've compared them to American alligator, for example. If not managed, can actually become a nuisance species, but also commercially valuable. So red-eared sliders, most of the professional groups, and there's a number represented in the room here, would agree that red-eared sliders probably are sustainable at some level. At the same time, we want to improve our annual reporting. Right now, We get information on 34 different species of mountain game, excuse me, including about 20 turtles. There is no reporting on the activity, the commercial activity of other non-game. The white list would actually expand the number of species that we would be getting information from, particularly snakes. But all other species would, of course, be prohibited for commercial use. So currently, you can see the list of critters that we are monitoring. The proposed list would expand nearly all species except turtles. The reporting would decrease from 13 to 1, and then all other turtles would be prohibited from commercial collection. So we're requesting permission to publish rules, including the implementation of a white list for the 85 non-game species. We want to propose a personal possession limit of 6 for those species not on the white list. We don't want a kid to not be able to pick up and keep a few turtles. That's important. So we would have a limited number that would be illegal to possess. We would prohibit the commercial collection of all turtles except red-eared slider. Then annual reporting would be required for species on the white list. In addition, we need to determine provisions for adding to or deleting species from that white list. That could be done through a simple petition. If a species looked like, depending on our information, was in trouble or being over-collected, we could take a species off that list. We could also add species to the list, depending on what the market determined and what we felt about the biology of the species. We've talked about how to handle people that already have these animals in possession. For those that are involved in commercial activity, we propose a 60-day period for divesting themselves of these critters, either through sale or some other means, but then grandfathering those for non-commercial purposes, for them to step forward maybe in a 12-month period so we can identify who has these animals. There's a lot of box turtles, for example, that some folks keep really as pets or maybe they're rehabbers. We want a way for them to keep those animals but not expand or not get into commercial activity. So that is our proposal for you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Matt, a couple of thoughts. I mean, clearly we need to address it. Having been to China recently, I see a lot of turtles at markets. I can understand the demand side of this. I wonder, over in the fisheries, it seems pretty clear from a policy standpoint that effective management regimes recognize value in the resource, try to create value and manage quantity rather than just allocate permits with unlimited quantities allowed under permits. I don't know how that adapts to this circumstance, but I wonder if we could, from a policy standpoint, when you bring it back, we'll look at alternative regimes that deal with sustainable quantities rather than just issuing permits or banning something that creates a black market that creates a big enforcement problem.
We agree that sustainability is the goal here. At this time, we feel like there is such an unlimited demand that there can be problems out there, so we're trying to get a handle on it in certain areas of the state. But especially with red-eared slider, I think that there can be some rules developed, maybe a bag limit, maybe a season. Some states do go that route, so we would definitely look at that.
Mr. Burke,
I have a couple of questions. Before I ask my first question, I want to lay out a premise that I think that we all subconsciously adhere to at this table, that a people cannot feed a people off of the resources of a natural resource. I mean, beginning more than 100 years ago, first it was a passenger pigeon, then they started talking about waterfowl, and waterfowl evolved up to 1934. And so forth and so on, and the even more presently the Bob Kemp idea of catch and release. everybody look at him.
But
I'm wondering if there is, and the other comment that I want to hear you say is, how easily can you educate the hunting, trapping public to be able to identify a red-eared slider just like that? And because I already know the answer to the question, it's difficult.
And we would need to engage in quite a bit of education, not just for the public, but I mean, we're moving into an area here of demand for wildlife that hadn't been in demand before.
That's right.
And we need to be able to train our game wardens, and we've got staff, we've got a lot of outside expertise willing to do that. And I think it's almost an exciting thing to think that for the first time turtles are ahead of white-tailed deer on the agenda. You know, it's
hallelujah. I've accomplished something in the last 6 years.
So, Your Honor, it is definitely a matter of public knowledge. I think most of the public does not realize the demand for turtles. And this has given us an opportunity to get in front of the issue, and I think address it in a reasonable way that includes the sustainability angle.
And I realize we have a time tomorrow for public input, but they're limited to 3 minutes. And I think this is a very, very serious situation that we have found ourselves in within the last 60 to 90 days, or maybe for you, 6 months. I'm wondering, is there anybody that you would like for us to hear from?
Well, I'll leave that up to you, but I would like to recognize our friend Dr. Lee Fitzgerald. You would raise your hand, Lee. There he is over there, and Dr. Michael Forstner, and especially Dr. Jim Dixon, who is here with us today. And there are other experts, I'm forgetting if I don't remember everybody, Rick Hudson, with the Turtle Alliance and others that support what we're doing. Some feel like we may not be moving fast enough.
I would like to hear from
Commissioner Barger, point of clarification, it is not on the agenda tomorrow.
It is not on the agenda tomorrow.
It is not.
Okay, then I would like to hear from these experts today.
Well, if I may, I would like to, Dr. Lee Fitzgerald, I think he addressed you last time, and we would like for him to, if that's what your wish is.
Please. So, Dr. Fitzgerald?
Got a question too, Peter.
Yeah.
Good afternoon.
My name is Lee Fitzgerald. I'm an associate professor in wildlife and fishery sciences at Texas A&M University. I'm not exactly sure if you want a summary or if you have a specific question, Mr. Parker.
I would like for you to give us an overall view of what the scientific community in our state thinks about this situation of commercialization of one of our natural resources, the foodstuff. And also, I would like for you to address what dangerous implications that this can have for human ingestion.
Okay. Well, first, before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge this commission for the. Yeah, for taking on this issue. I really appreciate your work, Dr. Cook, and your staff, Matt, and everyone that we've been talking to is doing a really good job. And this is to us, and I think it must be to you too, this is a big deal. These are some pretty sweeping changes that you're discussing today. I think above all, the the scientific community that that is heartened by your attitude toward this issue. I think I can summarize the broad consensus of the scientific community about turtle exploitation at several levels. One is what you were referring to, sir, about commercialization of wildlife. It's just the way that wildlife commercialization works everywhere in the world. Unregulated commercialization of wildlife benefits very few people, but it can cause great damage to our natural heritage. I've worked on wildlife trades for over 20 years and in North and South America, and these wildlife trades, turtles included, they're like selling Hoover vacuum cleaners. You know, a million salesmen for a million sales, but there's always a few individuals that you know, make that gain great livelihood out of these sort of loosely constructed trades. I think that banning commerce on turtles is very appropriate because of the biological attributes that turtles have that you're all very familiar with. I think the question you're forced with is whether you want to allow commercialization of one species of turtle, which sort of means you're going to embark on the path of wildlife management for turtles, as opposed to saying that no, you know, we're taking the decision not to take that step, and we recognize that people might need to use and appreciate non-game wildlife for their own individual reasons, but not sell it. There's the whole issue of turtle identification is a complicated one. I think that, I think it's possible, in my opinion, I'm not really talking about the whole scientific community here. I think if you consider the way that, you know, fishermen identify various fish species or duck hunters identify ducks, it's possible that, user groups of wildlife can identify turtles. That's not too much of a stretch. But that also, when we have those kind of policies, we know there's going to be a lot of mistakes in identification made, which means that there has to be more of this wildlife management policy regimes to kind of deal with that, engage that, and monitor, and then make continual adjustments to refine it. So what I'm pointing out is that you may be opening, somewhat of a Pandora's box by embarking on wildlife management for a turtle species. I think part of the reason that the Ritterd slider was kept on the white list is because there's an attitude that, oh, well, those Ritterd sliders, those are generalist, opportunistic turtle species. So if there's a turtle out there that can take it, it would be the Ritterd slider. Well, Dr. Wagner drew an analogy to the alligator. But we could extend that analogy a little bit, and I would like for you to consider that you shouldn't take the impression that Ritterd sliders cannot be overexploited. They certainly can be, just as the American alligator was. Another thing that I've been thinking about today is, we've been waiting for this, is if we're going to allow a commercial take of Ritterd sliders, I don't think they'll be driven to extinction or anything like that. They can be overexploited, which means that they'll have to go through a recovery period with lots of monitoring and management and research and whatnot. But it also means that there'll be fewer turtles out there. And I think back my whole life, and I think a lot of people think of this, paddling the canoe down the stream and you see the turtle stacked up on the log, and we appreciate that. That is a value that turtles have. When streams are fished for turtles, they become, less visible and there's fewer of them out there. I think that's something that we ought to consider also, how people are using turtles that are not actually catching them and selling them. I think that those are some of the fundamental comments I have about this issue. You asked about human ingestion of turtle meat, and I'm not an expert on that. But there are colleagues in the audience here who know much more about that than I do, and I think that they would be happy to explain to you that turtles are being taken from the same waters where fishing is prohibited because of risk of human consumption of those fish. Thank you. Thank you very much.
The question I had to do with the red ear slider, because my worry is, 60,000, let's say, other turtles now are going to be, we can't harvest. So now that the red ear slider just, now that it's at 178,000 bottom, it'll be 230,000. So we think about our summer relations at this point. So we sort this out along with banning all the turtles. I'm worried about, I mean, and, you know, wildlife management is what we do, so I don't, that myself isn't positive.
Taking all the pressure.
It seems to me that it should be some kind of
regulation or control
or a control study period or something. Otherwise, I'm going to just shift, and now these individuals who are doing this legitimately at this point.
Do we feel that the report, annual reporting requirement would serve that purpose for a period of a year?
Yes.
Well, we agree.
I think your point is...
My point is it controllable within a year time frame?
We can fashion some restrictions for red ears and during this period. I mean, some states go with a season. Some states go with a possession limit, something like that. I mean, at this time, we really don't feel like that... is the really an emergency, but well, we can certainly go that route. I mean, I think with the reporting that we're getting, we know who is involved in this activity. We know what counties these turtles are coming out of, and we can look more carefully at areas of concern if we need to. So we can definitely start working towards...
I'm interrupting.
No.
It's going to take a period of time to, let's say, you discover all of a sudden it's going up dramatically.
Right.
I assume these dealers who are not going to be able to buy these other 60,000 are going to look for a way to fulfill that need as it's being driven by the marketplace.
Right.
As you're aware of it.
Potentially exploit the other.
And exploit the red ear.
That's
what I'm worried about.
Chairman Fitzsimmons, real quick.
That's right.
Well, first, now I want to thank you for tackling this, and because it's clearly an area where we need to develop some effective regulations to protect this resource. I mean, we all, as Commissioner Parker said, you know, we've learned through history that market hunting is not a sustainable practice. That's just, you know, we quit doing that in other areas a long time ago. But there is an economic demand here, and what I'm concerned about is creating that black market Commissioner Montgomery talks about, where you may feel better about passing a regulation, but it doesn't really get the job done on the ground. So I want to make sure that you know, you look at all the unintended consequences in addition to the obvious ones. I'm concerned if Texas is a vacuum, that we're attracting a lot of pressure that we wouldn't otherwise have. I mean, so we got to address that. Am I correct in assuming that?
I think it's safe to say that there are, you know, the research that Robert McDonald, our REX coordinator, has done, essentially there are very few states that are more wide open than Texas. I mean, we are getting the monitoring. We permit this activity. So... We know where the problem areas are.
Okay.
We're on the verge now of what do we do with the information. And
right.
I think we can fashion that. I think, you know, I don't want to give the impression that we are endangering, especially red ear slider. They are statewide and abundant. They're opportunistic. In other words, they will live in habitats that most turtles wouldn't. So on private land, you know, where turtles are, or red ear sliders are very common, I mean, we know the situation. I think we can work towards some sustainability there without a problem.
Okay. What I want to make sure of is that we come up with a regulation that's enforceable and that doesn't just create a black market and an enforcement nightmare for Pete and his folks, and really does solve the resource issue of exploitation. Now, I gotta ask you, we start thinking, you know, there is that demand there. Is it practical to consider aquaculture, if that's the right term, farming? And then again, how would you again identify a wild from a farmed?
Well, you're talking about really a whole other dimension of this, and it is valid. Louisiana has a very extensive turtle farming operations, actually permitted to the Department of Ag, I believe. But that activity would be permitted separately, would have to be monitored. At some point, these farms do need to reinvigorate their populations for breeding purposes. I mean, China right now, a lot of these turtles that are being collected, the adults, are being used to establish Chinese turtle farms, extensive farming operations. And so they're actively getting in this business. And so I think it is a viable alternative here in Texas. We need to do some more investigation. We've got good models with shrimp farming and other situations.
Yeah, but then you've got all those disease issues like we have in aquaculture.
Yes.
And you worry that they have to be cognizant of spreading disease to the wild population and all that. Well, I think you're on the right track. But again, my concern, you know, from my experience is enforceability. Make sure enforceable, make sure you don't have unintended consequences.
David Sinclair is engaged every step of the way, and he has given us his input, and we're working very closely.
But clearly, the time, the day of market hunting should be long past.
Mr. Montgomery?
I'll repeat what the chair said. My concerns align with his. Same line of thinking, just a couple of the thoughts. I mean, we do, the morality of this is causing an emotional reaction. We do allow trapping, we do allow, you know, commercial fishing, we do allow a number of commercial activities. I think we want to not dramatize commercialization is inherently bad. We allow it in some places. I do think what Jones is describing is what I was trying to get at, not quantity for one person under a license, but we separate both private and public. If we are going to allow something in public, that we have a sustainability from an environmental standpoint, to me is great. Make a good policy and one that we adhere to in other places.
Yeah.
We have a very broad practice across the department of allowing private landowners to gain value from their resources and therefore to encourage conservation through value creation, whether that's farming or taking wild populations. I don't know, I'm not prepared to make that decision, but I would like to be able to come back with a range of options and managerial regimes that recognize fundamentally the demand is not going away, it will probably only grow, but we have to anticipate an environment in which the resource is probably more valuable if we don't create mechanisms for people to manage it intelligently and kind of crowd out the black market. We will end up with a black market and the tragedy of the commons that's playing out in these numbers right here if you don't want it.
So,
same direction there.
Yep. Definitely.
Mr. Burke, one more last thing. If we are going to do this, I would, with respect to public health, I would think that we would also want to hear testimony and receive evidence from our public health officials, because I think, for me personally, I would rather err on the part of quickness having to do with public health than to sit back and do nothing until somebody says, the building's on fire.
I anticipated that. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. And, there are really sort of two prongs to this issue. And one is the one that really is within our purview, and that has to do with sustainability of the species. I think some of the public health issues have arisen because we did receive a petition for emergency rulemaking. I believe you're aware of that. And, you know, based on our biologist's opinion regarding sustainability of the resource, I don't believe that there is a feeling that there is an emergency. The other issue that was raised, however, has to do with protection of human health. And there is an argument that the agency may have some authority on an emergency basis if there was something that was really serious. Now, what I would envision is, for example, if you had an outbreak of, say, anthrax, you may have several agencies get together, they all adopt a rule quickly, and then you sort out who really has authority, because any emergency rule is only effective for 120 days. And then if you want a long-term rule, you have to have statutory authority. Mm-hmm. As a result of the human health issues that have been raised, though, we've been in contact with the Department of State Health Services. I know that Matt has talked to a couple of people. I've talked to a couple of people over there. Yesterday I had a pretty long talk with one of their attorneys. And one of the things he indicated is if the terminals are being shipped live, they may or may not have authority over that. They have limited authority. However, if they are in fact being sold for human consumption, and we understand that they may be sold for human consumption in some Asian markets in Dallas and in Houston, they're willing to go in and look at those and to take whatever appropriate action is necessary. And we are working with them, and they are more than willing to help out in dealing with any potential human consumption issues.
Mr. I can make some comparisons here. When we had the first of the chronic wasting disease issues come up in the mad cow or the mad cow, mm-hmm. whatever it was, you know, and we dealt with some of those issues on a short period of time on an emergency basis, but at the same time, we worked very, very closely. Day to day, minute to minute, with the Texas Animal Health Commission, we're doing the same thing here with these folks. Our purview is, as a, is the resource, and that's what we must base this on and work on, and we'll continue to proceed as you're put in y'all's direction. We think this is something worthwhile, we think it's important, and we'll be moving forward as per your direction.
And if I could just make a quick comment on our previous history regarding emergency rulemaking. In 1998, I understand that there was an emergency rule regarding redfish. In 2002, there was an emergency rule regarding CWD, which is the one that Mr. Cook just mentioned. In both of those, the justification was the resource, the sustainability of the resource.
It seems to me with the level of discussion we've had in this brief time today that are we ready to make these proposed regulation changes, or do we need to submit this to further discussion prior to making these?
Well, I personally believe that we need to accept Matt's recommendation, because that gives us a starting point from which to launch.
You know, one option, if you are considering, for example, the red-eared slider, If you think there is the possibility that you're going to want to prohibit that one as well, what we could do in the proposal is go ahead and not include that on the white list. We could add it when it comes back to you in late May. You know, in proposing a rule, what we try to do is make sure that we make it as restrictive as possible, knowing that we may want to liberalize it when we come back. So that is also an option. Or
question
the
back.
My recommendation is to go forward with a proposal as laid out by Matt,
right,
and come back to the commission in May.
Yes, sir.
And you know, we can decide at that point in time. We can extend at that point in time. We can broaden or, you know, have a lot of flexibility.
That's the time, is it not, Ann, to consider your option of being more restrictive? Or would it be now?
We'd want to make it less restrictive, generally. Usually, it's kind of a rule of thumb that we've used in terms of ability to change a proposal without having to go through the republication process.
Right. We don't have to republish it if the change is less restrictive.
It's less restrictive.
Right. More restrictive now.
Yeah, so the idea, so what you're saying is we can make a recommendation now to make it more restrictive, and then after public input and comment,
have
the benefit of all the public comment and testimony, and then if the commission decides in May to be less restrictive, it may, without a republication, and you don't lose time.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, so then you're saying that we can include the red-eared slider,
yes,
on the white list now.
Nothing on the white list.
It would be added to.
The proposal would be you prohibit it all.
You prohibit it all.
You prohibit it all.
You would be opening that up.
Yeah. That's what I'm.
by various commissioners.
Just take them all on.
Right.
Another issue I want to just point out, because this is going to be an issue in the rule proposal. Whenever we're proposing a rule that's going to have an impact on a small business, we have to do a fairly extensive small business analysis. Whenever a rule is challenged, that's one of the first things that a challenger will look at. And so knowing kind of what the world is will help us a lot in preparing the small business.
And to get the health issues within the boundaries of the state of Texas involved at that time.
And we can definitely do
well,
that.
Yes, we can look at, just for your information, I mean, we did some looking. There is a ban on fish consumption in about four or five counties in the Trinity River. But when you look at our data, only a relatively small number of turtles were coming from that immediate area. So, I mean, that we know they're underreported, but at this time we don't feel like there's an emergency.
If everybody's telling the truth.
Right. And we know it.
That's a question.
Right.
Mr. Ramos.
I don't know if you're ready to entertain the motion on this issue, but I would.
Any other discussion? Did you say we're not?
Well, there's no motion.
Right. There's no need for a motion.
Yeah, just instruct the staff.
Correct. Any other questions? Discussion?
The red flag would be on.
To make
on
it as restrictive as possible. That was what I was going to suggest.
Motion is, right.
Recommendation.
Recommendation.
Very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we'll go with that.
Thank you, Matt.
You very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Did a good job.
All right. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number four, amendments to the public lands proclamation and permission to publish. Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I'm Mike Berger, Wildlife Division Director. I'm glad to be here before deer as well. We've got some housekeeping amendments today to propose for the regarding the public lands proclamation and later one under the state parks proclamation. The first of these has to do with the off-highway fee and decal. This fee was established to fund the purchase, development, and maintenance of off-highway vehicle trails as part of a program administered by the department. And our intent with that was, with respect to the funding, was to rely on the true off-road vehicle or off-highway vehicle enthusiast to fund the recreational trails program for that purpose. And we've determined that the use of mobility-enhancing conveyances by disabled persons participating in our public hunting lands program isn't really consistent with that policy and that they should not be subject to the fee. So basically this proposal is when disabled persons or their assistants come to state parks or wildlife management areas for public hunting, that they their vehicle not be required to pay that fee or to have that decal fixed. The next three items are related and are necessary in order to comply with federal requirements that oblige the department to keep the funds from the sale of permits for access to state parks separate from the funds for the sale of special permits for access to wildlife management areas. So these proposed amendments would acknowledge that decision by rule, and the effects of the proposal are non-substantive, and they do not create any new fees nor impose any existing fees. So the first of these is to establish a definition of special access permit. So that goes in 65-191, a special access permit. The second part of this in 65-193, a section called access permit required and fees, applies that definition, special access permit, in a number of places so that it becomes a required item. And the third part is in the state parks proclamation, where we establish fees for the access permit as part of the state park regulation. And this will establish the fee for these special access permits at $75 for up to 3 days and $125 for more than 3 days, up to 5 days. These are the fees that are in place right now. There's no change. It just establishes them as the fee for the special access permit. And that's our little housekeeping proposal.
Any questions?
Discussion, questions?
Okay. Straightforward.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions or discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required comment, public comment period. Committee item number 5, amendments to deer management permit rules and transport and transplant rules, permission to publish. Ms. Lockwood. We finally got the deer.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I am Mitch Lockwood, and I'm the statewide white-tail deer program leader. Today, I will brief you on a proposal to modify the changes of our rules pertaining to our deer management permit, commonly referred to as a DMP, and our trap, transport, and transplant permit, commonly referred to as Triple T, with the intention of simplifying these permitting processes and also an attempt to recover all costs in the administration and enforcement of these programs. Now, I presented this proposal to our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee and to the Texas Wildlife Association's Deer Management Committee last week and received favorable responses. But there are a couple of items that we'll go through today that did generate quite a bit of discussion in our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee meeting. And I would like to share those comments with you because we'll be seeking your guidance on how we should proceed on those two items and whether or not we should modify this proposal before going to the Texas Register this Friday. The first change that we propose pertains to the rule pertaining to the DMP application. Current rule states that changes to an approved or previous deer management plan shall be considered as a new application. Now, this rule makes a distinction between new permit applications and applications for permit renewals because there's a difference in the fee between the two, with a permit renewal having a fee of $600 and a new application having a fee of $1,000. There's an assumption, I think, that the permit renewals carry less overhead with them, that we're able to turn them around more quickly. In reality, permit renewals have demanded more of our time for processing because of this rule, because we do have to determine whether or not any changes have been made to that deer management plan since last year, such as a change in the size of the facility or an additional gate or what have you. So we have designed a much more efficient process that would allow us to process all DMP applications, whether you're a first-time applicant or you've had a permit for 5 years. We propose to process all applications consistently, which will allow us to be more efficient and will be a more user-friendly program. And therefore, we propose to simply strike this language from the rule. Next, we recommend a change to the composition of the respective review panels. You may recall that a permit applicant may request to review an agency decision to deny or delay a permit issuance. This is true of all deer permits. But the various review panels that we have were not created simultaneously. They've been phased in through time, and as a result, there are some inconsistencies between these different review panels. It is our belief that the review panel for Triple T and DMP permits should include senior management and should be consistent with the review panel of the scientific breeders permit. And therefore, we propose to add the deputy executive director for operations and remove the regional director and the whitetail deer program leader from these two review panels. Regarding the number of deer that may be detained within a DMP, the current rule states that no more than one buck or 20 does may be detained between September 1st and January 31st. Including these dates in the rule is somewhat confusing because the fact of the matter is the way we've been operating these programs is to allow that permittee to continue to detain these same 21 deer all the way through the end of August. Through August 31st. And so we're, except of course during those latter months, May, June, July, and August, they're likely to have fawns in those pens as well. And so we're attempting to simplify and clarify this rule by simply stating that regardless of the permit period, at no time may a DMP facility contain more than one buck and 20 does, except for the offspring or the fawns that are the product of those 21 deer. Now this is one of the items that did generate quite a bit of discussion at our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee meeting last week. Some permittees would like to hold on to these fawns or rear them in these pens as long as possible, ostensibly to increase fawn survival. In fact, there's at least one advisory committee member that would prefer a permit period that would extend 12 months from the date of purchase. For example, one may choose to wait till November 1st, for example, to purchase or activate a DMP, which would then allow that person to take those fawns that are born the next summer in that pen and hang on to those fawns and rear them in that pen all the way through October 31st, for that example. And again, one may prefer to do this with the hopes of increasing fawn survival. I should say that there are some researchers on the advisory committee who suggested, provided some arguments suggesting that while fawn survival, or fawning rates rather, are indeed higher in pen facilities, actual overall recruitment, actual recruitment of fawns into the population could very well be lower for fawns that are reared in a pen as opposed to fawns that are dropped and reared out in the pasture. They provided justification to support their claims. The argument or the discussion really it went from there to center or focus on what the true intent of the DMP is. DPW code states that the intent of the DMP is for propagation purposes. Our rules adopted immediately after state that a DMP is for natural breeding purposes only. And so there are a number of members on this committee who are concerned that this DMP program has evolved to allow for practices that are permitted under a whole other permitting program altogether, the scientific breeding program. And last on this topic, I think it's important that I note when we presented this to TWA's Deer Management Committee, a couple of their members who are real active in advising and consulting with a number of DMP permittees, they've been involved in this program from the beginning. And they specifically recalled and wanted to point out that based on their recollection, it was always their understanding that the intent of this program was indeed to improve or increase the breeding success of one exceptional buck, but then to release that buck and those 20 does soon after breeding. So, having covered that, this is where I kind of point to you, and I'm seeking your guidance as to how we should proceed with this item, whether or not we should modify this proposal. It might be a good idea if I briefly summarize the three options as we see. The agenda item that you received does not propose to change the mandatory release date of August 31st. One option, as we see, is to completely alter the structure of the deer management program to allow for a permit period that extends 12 months from the date of purchase. Another option would be to modify the regulation to allow for, or rather to require the release of deer very soon after breeding, where those does are then falling out in the pastures. And then finally, the third option that we recognize would be that we continue with a 12-month permit program that extends, as it currently does, from September 1st to August 31st, which, of course, would continue to allow these fawns to be born and reared in the pens all the way through August 31st. So the third option really wouldn't be a change. And again, this is, we're kind of sticking yours. Got it.
Mid August is a pretty bad time to be releasing deer, and that's a lot of stress. You know?
Well, one of these researchers that I referred to earlier has quite a bit of experience from breeding operations to all kinds of wildlife research over the years, and he concurs completely with what you just said. His experience is that fawning, or rather deer survival, fawns and adults is much higher when released in the spring of the year as opposed to when released in the fall of the year. And there are some reasons, or at least speculations, as to why that may be. But yes, sir, there are committee members that agree with that comment.
Okay, well, and one, just one other comment rather than question is, since I was around when those discussions were being, I guess I was chairman of private lands back then when we did the GMP, the memory of those TWA members is correct. That's, you know, it wasn't so much that it be one buck and 20 dough, but clearly that the intent was that the deer be released after the breeding. I mean, that was the discussion. The memory is correct.
And it was fairly split at the advisory committee?
Well, what I'll tell you is there was not a clear consensus.
What's wrong? Let's see, in essence, what is the objection to releasing right after the breeding season where the does have their fawns, just like any other doe?
Well, the idea is if you have fawns in a pen, you give them all the food they need, all the water they need, perhaps protecting them from predators to some extent. And they do report very high fawning rates. Some of these committees do, no question about it. But some of these committees also report very high fawn mortality when those gates are open. And I won't expand on the potential reasons for that unless asked, but the idea, again, is there's a belief by some that the longer they rear fawns in a pen, the higher fawn survival they will end up with.
And if you raise them in a pen, aren't you creating an artificial environment to where when you release them, aren't you, to some extent, shocking the animal as compared to letting the doe be bred and immediately releasing it to where the fawn is born in the environment that it was designed to be born in?
That is an argument shared by some of those committee members, and I prefer to comment on some of their comments as opposed to maybe provide my particular opinion. But one idea along the lines of what you're saying is that the rumen flora of fawns that are pen reared is different than the rumen flora of fawns that are reared in a pasture. And one member in particular spent quite a bit of time discussing this with the committee and questioned whether those fawns are able to adjust or adapt to that native vegetation when released. It was no surprise to this committee member that some of these DMP permittees are seeing high fawn mortality when the gates are open. It didn't surprise them at all. And it could be because of that rumen flora. It could be because, as Chairman Fitzsimmons mentioned earlier, the spring of the year is obviously a time when the pastures are wearing their Sunday breeches. Fords, good nutrition out there, good fawning conditions, relatively speaking. And so there are a number of people who commented similar to what you just provided.
Do I understand right? All these programs to allow landowners to breed without paying buck and then release but not turn into a secondary breeder program.
Yes, sir.
Would it be consistent with that policy to just give landowners the flexibility to make that choice?
In terms
so
of when
they
release,
give
them the choice when to release?
Yeah. Through August 31st. Would that be consistent with the policy of the program?
Try one more time, please.
To be consistent with the policy of that program, the policy you just said was the policy of the DMP program to give the landowner the choice of when to release those fawns prior to August 31st.
Well, I see that as an option. The reason I'm struggling here is to say whether or not it's consistent with the intent of the rules. That obviously generated quite a bit of discussion at our meeting. Some say if it's for natural breeding purposes only, then that would not include fawn rearing. And so that was the argument that I refer to their discussions as opposed to interjecting.
Well, they're suggesting would provide some flexibility.
Yeah, no later than
assuming there is no.
Yeah. Next trying to keep up with the policy level.
To be fair,
we're not the deer managers.
I want to be fair and make sure I do completely address all the sentiment that came out of the committee, and one suggestion, Chairman, was indeed to allow the landowner that flexibility. What landowner would knowingly do something that, that he knew would result in lower ponds and survival, and it may be a more of an education effort to teach them how you might behoove yourself by releasing these ponds earlier and kind of take that approach. That was indeed a suggestion out of that meeting.
And that, Mitch, is basically what that proposed rule does. It leaves the landowner the flexibility. He could turn them loose for February the 1st. He could turn them loose April the 1st. He could turn them loose August 31st.
Yes, sir. And what you see in front of you right now would basically say that at no time may you hold more than one buck 20 does and their offspring the following summer. Release them when you want, but no later than August 31st.
I think that's, in other words, that's, yeah, that's where you were coming from. So we just got to make sure that the commission is comfortable with that policy.
Right. Which is the way it's, right. I think I understand your confusion a little bit in terms of how it's written, but, okay. So do you want to carry on a little bit, and then we'll...
Well, that's what you'd like.
Treat it as a...
Let me just clarify one more point. From a biological standpoint, is there an agreement that if you release them in August as compared to the spring, that you're going to have a greater mortality? Or
there's not a consensus, no, sir. No, sir. There was, well, there is some science, but that's one of those items that there will continue to be some debate on. Those that suggest higher survival in the spring of the year or provide some new information to get people to chew on.
So I think at this point we can just say that we will carry forward with a staff recommendation on this.
Currently, our DMP rules also state that no trapping of deer under DMP may take place between March the 2nd and August 31st. This rule is misleading because it implies that one may trap deer for DMP on March 1st, which is not the case. Since the intent of the rule is for natural breeding purposes only, we do not permit the trapping of deer beyond a date in which there is a high probability of trapping pregnant does. In order to maintain the intent and the integrity of this program, we refer to data collected from our statewide breeding chronology study. And we use those data to establish cutoff dates. When is the last date that you can trap a deer for each ecoregion? And those data indicate, as I'm sure we all know, that South Texas does have the latest breeding season for whitetails in the state, with December the 14th being the last day when there's not a high probability of trapping a pregnant doe. And therefore, we propose to clarify this rule by stating that nowhere in Texas may you trap a deer after December the 14th for DMP. Now, if this is adopted, we would include a table in the application packet that would show these various cutoff dates for each ecological region in the state. Obviously, the post-oak savanna has an earlier breeding season, and therefore it has an earlier cutoff date. I must be going backwards. Next, we propose to eliminate the ear tagging requirement. Current rules require that all adult deer in a DMP facility be ear tagged. We've determined that this practice isn't necessary. It really provides little value to the department. And so we propose to simplify the rule and to provide a little more flexibility by eliminating this requirement. This proposal would not exclude somebody, or prohibit, rather, somebody from tagging deer legally detained in a DMP, which some people like to do. There was quite a bit of discussion on this item at the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee meeting. There are some on the committee that recommended that the department prohibit ear tagging for any DMP deer, whereas others see the value being that it could provide some insight as far as fawn survival. It also enables people to do what's common practice, and that is to locate those fawns again next year under a new permit, when they're yearlings, of course, trap them again, bringing back that DMP for breeding purposes. Those that would like for us to prohibit ear tagging are concerned again that this program has kind of evolved into one that allows for practices such as line breeding that are allowed under another permit altogether, that the scientific breeding program.
Excuse me, does that mean then that you could tag on?
This rule, if adopted as proposed in the draft agenda item you received, would not require you to tag deer, but would allow you to tag any deer in the DMP.
Which could have some research relevance. I mean, is that your feeling?
It could have some research relevance. Some of the discussion at the advisory committee meeting was research-oriented, and a suggestion was, well, let's do that under a research permit. That was one suggestion.
Yeah.
Mr. Burke, is there any issue, law enforcement issue, with this?
No, sir. Law enforcement supports the elimination of this requirement 110%.
Good question.
Okay.
Any other questions? On
law enforcement just needs to count heads.
Okay.
And so, before, just for clarification, unless you would like to wait, Chairman, this is an item where we're kind of seeking your guidance, too, as to whether or not we should stick with what we've got or modify this proposal.
I suggest we stick with what we have and simplify it. And if people want to tag, they can tag.
Okay, thank you. Next, we propose more flexible standards for the liberation of DMP deer. Current rules require that one remove at least 100 continuous yards of fence or open at least 100 continuous yards of gate for a period of at least 60 days to facilitate the release of these deer. Our rules allow us to approve exceptions to this 100-yard or 60-day rule, which would commonly do. We have made so many exceptions over the years that we've come to believe that requiring an opening of only 20 feet would suffice. In fact, we think it would be fine to allow multiple openings to meet this 20-foot requirement so long as no opening is less than 10 feet wide. So, for example, instead of laying down 100 yards of fence, this proposal would allow you to open two 10-foot gates on opposite ends of the pen, for example. And that would suffice. We also believe that keeping these gates open for a period of only 30 days would be sufficient to facilitate this release. The latter component would be beneficial to those who are operating in areas with earlier breeding seasons. Let's take that close-up savanna, for example, that has a mid to late October peak rut. They need to start trapping early. Some of them may want to start trapping September 1st. Current rules will not allow one to start trapping deer for DMP on September 1st unless you get the deer that are currently in your pens out of there by the end of June. As we've discussed, some people like to hang on to those fawns later, and hopefully to increase survival. This proposal would allow one to hang on to those fawns all the way to the end of July and still begin trapping again September 1st. And again, a lot of people want to hang on to those deer all the way to the end of August. Current rules won't let them start trapping until November. This rule would allow you to start trapping in October. And so, again, this would help those that are needing to start trapping earlier because of these cutoff dates we propose.
Discussion, comment? Comfortable with that?
And real briefly, there was not much discussion at all on that item. Everybody kind of, they liked that idea on the advisory committee. But they did bring to our attention a couple of oversights in the existing regulations. And that is, one of the rules says that you also have to remove your artificial feed and water when you open your gate. And the rule says for 60 days. Of course, we're proposing to make that 30 days. But the regulation does not specifically say that the water and food must be removed during that same 60-day period. And so there really is a loophole there that could allow someone to detain these deer indefinitely. Our advisory committee, there was a consensus on this, that they recommended that we do clarify this and state that food and water's got to be gone the same time that the gates are open during that liberation period. And we ask your permission to make that change before we publish.
Okay.
Timmy, I hate to raise this issue, but let's say you have a stock tank with
artificial. Stock tank would be fine.
What are you doing down there?
Stock tanks, we don't have any well water. It's all run off what God gives us. Everybody in Texas got to fill their bill. I think if you have to put that out, it'd be a valuable resource. It's going to waste.
I can't wait to tell them that. Yeah.
We're getting fairly close here. The other item that they saw as an oversight, a couple of advisory, actually several of these members are advisors or consultants to those with these permits, and they informed us that there are a number of pens out there, DMP facilities, that have gates that actually open into another small enclosure, like a 5-acre pasture, if you will, and again allow them to have a modified breeder operation, and there was consensus on this item and that they recommended that we clearly state that the gates you open need to be exterior gates that open to the pasture in which the deer were captured.
Yeah.
And we'd ask your permission to make that clarification as well.
No halfway house. Okay.
Okay, last part. Not last slide, but last part of this proposal, and that is the seed. Again, the last component is to try to recover all costs associated with the enforcement and administration of these permits. We're operating under the same philosophy that this commission proposed and endorsed a little over a year ago when we increased the scientific breeder fees, and that was to recover all costs associated with administering this program, that program. In addition, Parks and Wildlife Code states that the state may not incur any expense for the trapping, transport, and transplanting of game animals and game birds under a triple T. In FY06, the department incurred a cost of nearing $121,000 for processing applications, performing site inspections, observing and enforcing compliance, and even prosecuting violations. Triple T regs. Again, about $121,000 of expense during that same permit period. The revenue was approximately $13,500. So, our first attempt to recover costs is to modify or limit the number of release sites that you can include on a Triple T application. The current rule allows for one application to have multiple trap sites and multiple release sites. For $180, you can have one application with one release site or one application with six release sites. Obviously, it costs us far more money to conduct site inspections or browse surveys or habitat evaluations on six sites than one. That $180 comes nowhere near covering the cost of processing an application with only one release site. And therefore, our first attempt here was to limit the number of release sites per application to one. Now, there was a recommendation from our advisory committee pertaining to this. I'd like to bring that back to you in just a moment. Mm-hmm. The next effort or attempt to recover costs has to do with the fee increase itself. Again, $180 allows you to trap, transport, and transplant deer in the state, and it's not allowing us to make ends meet. We propose to just make ends meet to increase that fee to $750. That would allow us to recover the cost for one release site, an application with one. Now, having said that, our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee and Texas Wildlife Association's Deer Management Committee expressed no concerns, voiced no concerns regarding this fee increase. But our advisory committee did recommend that we continue to allow for multiple release sites on application, but to impose a fee of $750 for each release site that is on the application. In other words, they're fine with the fee increase, but they advise that we continue to try to make this process as simple as possible. Reduce the amount of paperwork. We concur. We continue to strive to simplify all permitting processes are regular in general. And so with your permission, we would ask to change what is in your draft agenda item to say that we would continue to allow for multiple release sites, but to impose a fee of $750 per release site.
How many triple T's do we issue?
We had, in the fiscal year that we looked at, which is last fiscal year, we had 163 release sites for triple T permits.
And typically for a TTP permit, how many release sites do you normally have on average per TTP permit?
Well, this grows each year. For the purpose of establishing a proper fee to recover costs, we focused on the most recent fiscal year that we had data for, and that was 163 sites. We speculate that number will continue, especially if there are no changes here, would continue to increase annually. We saw a dip early on because of the CWD testing requirements for trap sites, but we have seen it start to climb again. So I certainly speculate that it will be higher than 163 release sites and continue to climb annually, but that's speculation. And finally, we're attempting to make a similar modification to our deer management permit fees. As I mentioned earlier in this presentation, currently there's a different fee between renewals and new applications, a difference of $400. But I also explained that the renewals actually have required more of our time. We do propose a more efficient process where all DMP applications are treated in the same manner and therefore all impose the same fee of $1,000. This would, based on our calculations, just recover costs for enforcing and administering this program, and this is the maximum amount allowed under statute.
In the fee discussion at the advisory committee, everyone was...
Both the White Cliffs Deer Advisory Committee and TWA's Deer Management Committee voiced no concerns. In fact, our advisory committee provides suggestions on how we could continue to make it simpler and still receive that same fee.
Good.
I don't know what's happened behind
right.
the coffee shop afterwards, but.
Okay.
Commissioners, this does conclude my presentation. I believe I've received clear guidance on how to proceed. Just for clarification, we will change what is in front of you before publishing Friday for those items where staff concurs with it and there was consensus from the advisory committee. And those items where there was not consensus, we'll make no changes to.
Thank you very much. Any more questions or discussion from this? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. We're making headway. Committee item number six is 2007-2008 statewide hunting and fishing proclamation. And
good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski of the Inland Fisheries Division, and today I'm going to go over our proposals that we brought before you in January and give you a summary of what we received in the way of public comment. The first proposal we're dealing with is for Lake Texoma. The current regulation there on striped bass allows a daily bag of 10 fish, and possession limit there is also 10, which is twice the statewide daily bag, which is 5, not the Texoma daily bag. We did make a proposal to make a change there, to change the possession limit for striped bass to 20, which would be twice the Texoma daily bag. Well, hopefully that will alleviate some of the angular confusion we've had on that. We don't think it will have any biological impact. The population can handle that. And we'll still have a few differences with Oklahoma, but those are due to some definitions of final destination on products, and we really can't handle that in the context of this. The comments we did receive on this were mostly for this proposal. All of these were received by the way of our website. We did have a public hearing in Sherman there, and we didn't receive any comments on the proposal at that time at that meeting. The next one is extending the legalization of bow fishing for catfish. and we did that last year.
Bill doesn't know what's coming.
Look at his screen. I'm not going to say it.
Y'all want to see his screen?
He was three jumps ahead.
That was implemented last year for 1 year, and what expired is August 31st. So we started collecting information on that. Game warden of bow angler contacts and survey of bow anglers. Most of that was done actually prior to the change was implemented. Mostly in the spring and the summer prior to the change. So we're proposing to extend that change for another year and hopefully collect a little bit more information. We did receive a number of comments on that, mostly four, and a few against, and we did all these except for one were received off our website, and one of the public hearings, one person did show up to speak against that.
It's all one under name, you have vote paper in the whole state.
Are we seeing a trend?
Are we seeing a trend?
That's based on that, we wouldn't recommend any changes proposed or not. So just take any questions if you have any.
Do we have any data on numbers for bow fishing?
No, we really don't. The few bow fishing groups, we did try to do a survey. I contacted them. I think we have received about 80 or so surveys back. There, a lot of them are reluctant to directly give you mailing lists, things like that.
So, let me ask you a question. Has our philosophy of catch and release changed in any way, shape, or form?
Well, we don't have for catfish, we do allow them to harvest, under regular means, and that's, harvest some fish. We're all, we still support harvest of catfish, but we do have, selective harvest.
But if they're under length, they're encouraged to,
certainly
return them to the water.
Return those fish on the side.
Talking about
split
on the
deck.
Okay,
thank you.
We'll kick it out.
Right.
Yeah.
Mike.
No, we know you'd already gone forward.
Where'd you go?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Lodge Director, here today talking about our proposal for us wildlife parks of the changes to the state wide. First of these has to do with the spring Rio Grande turkey season. 2 years ago, we modified this season to add some extra opportunity. We changed the season length by a week, and we eliminated the north and south zones. In the process of monitoring and evaluating these changes, we determined that the 44-day season length is fine, but the hunting opportunity could be further optimized by reinstituting the zone system, allowing South Texas to open earlier, and we propose that the North Texas season run a little later. This was the zone map as it is for the turkey season in progress right now, and this would be the turkey map as a result of the change. The South zone in yellow that you see there would open the Saturday closest to March 18th, and North Zone in red would open the Saturday closest to April the 7th, and both seasons would run for 44 days and would be gobblers only. We did discuss this proposal in depth with the Game Bird Advisory Board, and they were very supportive of the proposal. However, during the comment period, we did receive a number of comments, and they were 103 to 68 in opposition to the proposal. And the most usual item discussed there was the delaying of the opening of the North Zone. Most of the comments that were opposed to the proposal, or a large number of them, indicated that they would prefer that the season in the North Zone open as it is now at the Saturday closest to April 1st. And since this is not a biological issue, not a resource issue, I think I would recommend that you would modify that proposal to allow the North to continue to open Saturday closest to April 1st and run for 44 days. So that really we would only be changing the season rate in the South.
South. Right.
Next item is some mule deer housekeeping. You'll recall that a couple of years ago we adopted rules to eliminate double tagging, or the use of
tag off the license when we're issuing a different kind of tag, like an MLD, a LAMPS, a special drawn hunt permit on WMAs, etc. And when we issued those rules, we inadvertently failed to include the general antlerless mule deer permits on there. So this proposal, if adopted, would eliminate the double tagging of antlerless mule deer taken under the authority of the general antlerless mule deer permit. And the comments on that were 57 in favor and 15 opposed. So it was in support. Also, when we implemented the mule deer MLD program a few years ago, we inadvertently failed to make provision for the archery mule deer season. And so we proposed to make the mule deer, the MLD permits for mule deer, valid for the archery season with archery equipment only as well. And that was widely supported too, 88-13 in favor of that proposal. With regard to the archery deer season, we had heard from the archery deer hunting community, and they were expressing a desire to have the some additional time, and this is that period that was closed between the end of the traditional archery season and the start of the general season. There was a 5-day period in there when the season was closed. And so this was a proposal to add those days to the archery season prior to the opening of the general firearm season. Again, this was, we've heard from a lot of archers, and they're in favor of that, 139-39 in favor of that proposal. With regard to lesser prairie chickens, the proposed regulation changes would give our field staff working in prairie chicken areas more flexibility to enroll more landowners in the Managed Lands Prairie Chicken Program. Most landowners interested in the program are already conducting a number of habitat management activities that are chicken-friendly, and so therefore the requirement of 5 we feel is a little overly restrictive, and it could be reduced to 3. And then because of the flecking behavior, the behavior of the males on the booming ground and their large home ranges, they use habitat that is often provided by a number of landowners, not restricted to one landowner. For example, the nesting and feeding areas may be on one landowner while the lek on the booming ground is on another landowner. And so the variability in land ownership sizes can make issuing permits challenging, especially when the birds are spending only a small amount of time on one habitat component. So increasing the harvest, allowing the harvest to increase to 10%, would allow our biologists to make issuance of these permits more equitable to the landowners in the program and encourage more participation and improvement in lesser prairie chicken management.
How many landowners do you have signed up currently?
In the program, I would imagine now there are about a dozen. I'd have to get that number for you.
Are there any in the southern area?
Yes. They're in both parts. In fact, I think more in the southwest panhandle.
But the acreage is over 100,000 acres, I mean, of those 12.
I'd have to get that for you. I don't know that it is that large, but that might be a very large acreage. 55-7 in favor of this proposal. So that was endorsed as well. Javelina. Had been petitioned by a private landowner to allow additional hunting opportunity on javelinas in South Texas by increasing the bag limit. At the last commission meeting, you authorized us to publish a proposal to allow javelina hunting under a managed lands format that is currently widely in place for deer. Under this proposal, there would be requirements for a collection of population and harvest data and habitat management. So that proposal was out there. It was a little closer, but it was 56-45 of commenters in favor of that javelina.
And then again,
56-45 in favor. And I'll update these numbers for you tomorrow to see if anyone's coming over.
Is the data requirement for this the same as for the deer?
It would be similar. We would want to have some population estimate. And we want harvest records, and we want habitat management practices. 2 years.
Will the harvest record include the hunter?
We
the hunter's name.
I believe they normally keep those records, yes.
Do they turn them in to you all?
What we're usually interested in are the biological data and not the hunter's name.
No, it's not.
I mean, on the MLD permit itself, of course, the hunter has to have his name on there as it's a transport permit. This slide just shows where the javelina seasons are now, that it's a year-round season in the south and a shorter season.
I think Mike addressed the worry that I've heard certainly is about javelina, and I think we've seen some articles. So, I mean, there are going to be areas that there's not going to be any permits because there's no javelina, or there's a real shortage of javelina in certain parts of the state.
And that's what we discovered.
Not uniformly distributed.
No, not here.
That's what we discovered when we evaluated this petition.
Right.
That there are areas that their habitat is sufficient, javelina populations are sound and strong, and you can make a harvest recommendation on those areas.
Those are annual permits.
Those are annual permits, yes, sir.
So we will have a record of somebody holding this permit, and we will know how many javelina that person has harvested under this permit.
Yes, sir. He will be issued a harvest recommendation, a quota of javelina for that property, just like he would under a year permit.
Mike, I think the important here, the general regulation season migrants do not change. This proposal is applicable to people in the managed land program
only. They're going to have to have a wildlife management plan.
Harvest rates to be recommended by the biologist, data to be reported, turned back in.
That's correct.
Right, based on the carrying capacity of that specific habitat.
And it's voluntary. If you're in an area where you have a lot of food to be part of, you don't just stay with the regular system.
Yeah. That's correct.
Okay.
There's going to be a managed lands permit issued to that landowner saying that it does thus and so, and he will be allowed to take action.
He's going to have to meet those requirements before he proceeds the permit. He's going to have the habitat management, be doing the habitat management work that's required, and he's going to have to agree to keep those population and harvest records. It's very similar to the white-tailed deer program. Okay, the last item is the taxidermy tagging requirement that currently taxidermists are required to maintain their records, their documentation for their work for a two-year period after the work is complete. And as we know, sometimes the person who ordered the work doesn't pick it up in a necessarily really timely fashion. So law enforcement would request that we have the taxidermist maintain his documentation for a two-year period after the specimens have been returned to the customer or sold to recover the cost of the taxidermy. And that concludes our recommendations.
Okay, so we have a proposed amendment to the North Zone Turkey, or was that the recommendation? Okay.
That's the recommendation.
We all comfortable with that? Thank you, Mike.
Sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mayor McKinney.
Mr. Chairman, members of the old team, go through the presenters you've been waiting for for the last... For the record, I'm Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries, and joining me is Robin Rikerson, Director of Science and Policy for Coastal Fishing Regulation Proposals. And we have a number before you today dealing with the sheephead, diamondback, paraffin, tarpon, spotted sea trout, red snapper, and then a number of general items to review with you. Let's start with sheephead fishery first. And we talked about this before in our briefings. This is a group of fish that are commonly sought after, primarily from jetties and docks and that type of thing. And in keeping with the philosophy of trying to make sure that those fish that are often targeted for sport fishing purposes, that we allow them to reach sexual maturity and reproduce before they're taken out of the fishery. We're seeking to raise the minimum size limit from 12 to 15 inches. But we want to do this incrementally, which we want to make sure that if we were to jump from the 12 to the 15, that we didn't unknowingly preclude some folks from taking fish, the smaller fish that they typically take from jetties and so forth. So doing this incrementally will try to make sure that no one gets disenfranchised. They can continue to fish. But there's no biological issue here. We're just trying to get that direction. So that's the basis of that recommendation. We already talked a little bit about diamondback terrapins. Of course, this is one of the species that occurs along the coast there. As we talked about that, we are concerned about the growing commercial market for these through the internet and others, and would recommend that we set up no-take provisions for them to protect them in that way. ARPA proposal, let me spend just a minute on this. As we talked about in our briefing, we have a couple of options that we presented, and we went forward with the option of a catch and release because that was the most restrictive approach, because we wanted, if that was something we wanted to adopt, we had to have that on the record so that you could explore the options at any regard. We had a number of comments on them. Generally, and we certainly concur with this, that from a conservation standpoint, both either of these proposals has benefits. No one really kills these big fish much anymore. They do essentially catch and release, so that's there. And certainly, we had support for catch and release fishery. Our numbers there are 34 comments for and 9 against. And I think most of that comes from people like myself. We read about catching tarpon a lot. We don't necessarily do it, and it makes sense. But one of the things that I wanted to do, and I think I would make the point here, is that we often get the comments that our positions are made up before we come here, so why come and talk, why go through these folks meetings? Well, this is one where that was not the case. I hope that folks will remember this, because I know that there is a community out there of professionals that seek tarpon and really are trying to make a fishery out along the Texas coast. And I couldn't get them to really comment on it except kind of back channel wise. So finally, I got a hold of a few of them and got my regional director out of North Texas, Lance Robinson, just to go get these people and come in and say, come on guys, you need to tell us what you really, really think here. And what they came out with is that they felt that at this point we may be a little bit early to go to a catch and release type fishery. They thought it was a good idea, but really we needed to work with the other states, Mexico and others, to really establish a basis for that catch and release record so we're all consistent with it. They were afraid that we got too far out ahead of it, although that's would be far ahead of the crowd here, that we might preclude them some opportunities that they might otherwise have to catch state records and bring people into the fishery. And certainly we want to support them in that regard. And then we were also fortunate in that we had a couple of scientists that really worked on tarpon, and we talked to them too. And one of those, Dr. Jerry Aul, who's not the top tarpon researcher in the country, in the world, he's one of them. And he's about to publish a book on tarpon, and in that book he's redoing the relationship between length and weight. And we talked to him about our concerns here, making sure that we set a recommendation that was appropriate for allowing for a state record that would be conservation-oriented. And he actually took our data and his data and ran us some regression tables and came up with a recommendation which we would like to consider. And basically that thing is, we at this point would recommend a one-fish bag limit with a minimum length of 85 inches, which is an increase from the current length of 80. And he felt that had good scientific support, and this would be something that would, I think, continue to help our fishery still be conservation-oriented. And I would tell you, I'm still interested in catch release for these things. I think we eventually should go there, but I want to be cautious and make sure it's effective when we do, and so that would be the basis of that recommendation. Spotted sea trout, yes. You've seen these graphs before, and I won't spend a lot of time on those. Sort of, if you have any questions, we'll go back and look at them. Our concern being that the population of spotted sea trout in the lower lagoon lottery, which has traditionally been somewhat twice that we've seen in other estuaries, has been decreasing over the years. In fact, this year it finally dropped below that statewide average for the first time. Our concern with the spawning stock biomass, that continues to drop and has over those years as well. And when we look at the relationship, our link frequency rate data, we see that as the fish become legal to catch in the last few years, they've begun to disappear more rapidly than they have in the past, which is an indication of fishing pressure as a cause of that. that's been the basis of our taking a look at what we could do to try to restore that fishery to the world-class level that it really should be. And with that, our recommendation that we briefed you on last time was 5, and we continue to propose a 5-fish bag limit as something that we should try there to start that recovery. In that regard, we also took a look at where the extent of that regulation and in consultation with our law enforcement folks, we would propose creating the northern boundary at Marker 21, the land cut, and that would require all anglers in possession and landing of a spotted sea trout south of that marker and within the confines of the Laguna Madre, out to the mouth of the base of the jetty, that would be the defined area. One modification on that we want to make it real clear on that we're talking about all the coastal waters within the lower Laguna Madre, San Martin Lake, all of those areas. And when we originally talked to you about this, we were talking about extending this out to the ends of the jetty. Well, we got to thinking about that you could get in a situation there where you have a fellow fishing on the end of that jetty, and on the inside of the jetty they could have 5 trout, and on the outside of the jetty, on the ocean side, they could have 10. And that was so we backed that line back to the base of the jetty to make it clear that we're talking about there, to clear that up. So that's a little bit different than what we proposed, but that's just a way of trying to make it more easy to enforce. I do want to make one point with you here that, and sometimes we hear this in our proposal, someone will come up and testify that, well, I didn't hear about this, didn't have time to talk about it. That's not going to be the case with spotted sea trout. We had a series of scoping meetings up and down the coast. We had them in the spring. We had them in the summer, the fall, and the winter, as is noted by the green signs there, and of course during the public hearings, official public hearings in March, all up and down the coast. So we had many opportunities, and a lot of folks took advantage of them. So everyone that could be affected by this regulation has had the opportunity to say their piece, and many of them did. We also took the step of making sure that Robin and I did. We visited the staff of every legislator in this area to make sure they understood what was going on. We contacted the 15 regional county judges and their commissioner, offered to give presentations to them. None of them took us up on it, but we gave them the presentation. All the regional chambers of commerce, the Port Isabel Chamber asked us to do so, and we made one presentation there. And of course, all the regional CCA chapters, the sportsmen's clubs, and so forth. So we made an effort to make sure everyone heard about this, had a chance to tell us what they saw. And of course, it did. We've gotten quite a bit of information in. We had a petition of Mr. Parker, who presented that to us last time, from the Port of Mansfield Chamber of Commerce and the Port of Mansfield Fishing Tournament, sent us a series of form letters. I think one time they thought there were 800 in there, but once we once we took out the blanks and the duplicates and the unsigned letters, it came down to 398. Coastal Bend Guides Association recently sent us some similar form letters with signatures against 707. We had resolutions from the Port Isabel Chamber of Commerce in favor of the proposal. The Lower Laguna Madre Foundation also in favor of the 5-fish regulation. We received the internet petition. The group has been working on this for some time. With 2,097 individual names and addresses appended to their petition. Interestingly enough, some of those folks expressed some particular opinions about the numbers that we should recommend, and this is a breakdown of how those recommendations came together. Basically, at this point, we have some 2,256 comments in favor of and 1,137 comments in opposition to that proposal. A number of comments were put forward, and of course, the commissioners and chairman, is to the degree to which to talk about those today, we can. What I propose to do is that I've gone through the comments, or Robin and others have gone through those comments and kind of summarized the most frequently asked questions, the frequently made comments, and would be prepared tomorrow to give a little summary of that at that time rather than go through this part of it. And ahead of the public comment, kind of give you a framework to work on. So I will leave these for now unless any of you have specific questions or comments, and we can certainly address them as you might wish. Red Snapper, we had a number of proposals there, and although I need all the help I can get up here, particularly one of the reasons that I've asked Robin to join me is because he is the chairman of the Gulf Council, the Red Snapper issue we're going through right now is about as complicated and convoluted as anything I can think of. I have no way of keeping up with it. Robin is the recognized expert on it, right? And he has all his notes here if you have any questions.
Yes.
We had three proposals for you. One was to reduce our minimum length from 15 to 13 inches in anticipation of what the federal feds might do. Also to require the use of circle hooks, and then to mirror federal commercial regulations and state regulations. At this time, we would recommend not reducing our minimum length to 13 inches because the federal agencies have not acted. We do want to be try to mirror them in some regards because our objective with Red Snapper and statewide is to try to keep our season open year-round. It's the one opportunity we have for people to take advantage of state waters that our population won't hold it. But we don't want to get in a situation where the federal permits us to raise the limit offshore to 15 and we're stuck at 13 and everyone comes in to catch the small fish or something like that. So what we would recommend that you consider doing is things like you've done for migratory birds and others and shrimp, as well as at this point to delegate to the executive director of the rulemaking authority to respond to that federal action so that whatever action that they may take, we can reflect that and try to protect our inshore population, keep that, our goal being keeping that season open as long as we can. So that's what we recommend at this time. Circle hooks, I think that's a good recommendation. The feds are going to follow that eventually, but we can be out ahead of that a little bit and would recommend that Red Snapper may be taken using pole and line, but unlawful to use any kind of hook other than a circle hook. We don't want to get into different types of all types of circle hooks. We'll use a fairly broad definition, but circle hooks seems to be an appropriate. We'll certainly reduce mortality and hooking mortality, and that's a positive for us as well. A couple of points just to make sure that we're clear on that the use of circle hooks applies only to natural bait, not artificial. That as a practical matter, if you were to adopt this recommendation, it basically means if you're fishing offshore in state waters, you better be using circle hooks. I mean, because what a game warden is going to do, they're going to come up into your boat, they're going to open up your eyes, as you look at the eyes, you got a red snapper, now you better have circle hooks on your line. It just is prudent to do it anyway. So that's really the practical implication is that it's going to go that direction. And again, that's a conservation. Of course, it only applies to pole lines. Spear fishing and other things are not a thing. I don't know if you have anything on the red snapper that we need to cover. Any questions on red snapper? We can move on to kind of where we are.
One thing, said mirror federal regulations.
I got ahead of myself. I concluded it. Quick one. The other recommendation that we would request you to adopt that is to mirror the federal regulations in state law. So our game wardens have the opportunity, should they catch someone in illegal commercial operation, that they can either pursue that federally or in state court, whichever makes the most sense they can do.
But now, we're going to keep our limits at four.
We're not changing our recreational limits.
Very good. Even though the feds may go to shoot.
We're going to try to maintain that as best we can. Now, we're always watching it by life. We may come back with something in biology to speak differently, but that's important.
When we mirror the federal, are you picking up any objectionable rules or provisions? What do you think we're going
to? Well, I think what we're proposing, because we do have authority under 7902 to basically grant that authority to the executive, for you to grant that authority to the executive director, and our thought being then, as we move through these federal fishing regulations, since their timing doesn't match ours, we didn't have the time to see what they actually do and try not to be a year in front of them or a year and a half behind them, depending on our cycle and their cycle and so forth. So that's what we were talking about doing. We would look at each one of their recommendations and really make the determination whether we wanted to mirror it. For instance, Rick Parker, or one of you mentioned, the feds will be going to a two-fish limit. Mm-hmm. We will start the season April 21st with a four-fish bag limit. 11 days later, the interim rule that was published last week as a final rule will, in fact, have us going to a two-fish bag limit May 2nd.
In federal waters.
And in the state waters, we, of course, are still going to try to stay at 4 and 15 inches at this current time.
Coming back to whatever you call it, federal rule applying it to our state regulations.
Right, the individual fishing quota and the commercial fishing.
Right. We're still going forward with that.
We would go forward and mirror that because that's fine. I mean, we want to give our law enforcement guys every tool that they can have to deal with this. It's complicated enough, but we want to have to be able to go forward with what they can.
We use the money.
Well, and in reality, one of the reasons we want to do that, and it's understandable, because when you have to go through the Justice Department, They're not going to take smaller cases. They're only going to deal with the bigger cases. But we have some cases that we think are fairly significant, but not on that scale. So we want to have an avenue to pursue, and this will be our law enforcement chance to take them to court. Another proposal, again, we thought this was going to be one that was basically a technical one that we have. If you look at the italic regulation there, it says it's unlawful to use airboats or jet-driven devices to pursue and harass or harry fish. Our idea was that we have these new shallow draft boats. This is a vessel. That engendered a whole great amount of discussion out in the public comments of what is pursue, and is clients pursuing illegal? I'm fishing, I'm pursuing, harrying. It got very complicated, even though this law has been in the books since the 80s, but that brought it all up. So you know, this is what happens when you open these regs, and that's fine. But what we would recommend doing, just to try to make that clear, is to say it's unlawful to use any vessel to harass fish. We know what harassing is. We have those laws and those types of things. So at this point, we don't want to take a tool away from our law enforcement to use, and this would help at least get rid of the pursue and harry and make harass be the term that we did look at. And, of course, we do sunset all our regulations on a regular basis every 4 years. And in a year and a half, we'll be going through that process again. We'll come back and back from this rule and take a look at it then to see if it's should just go away or not. That would be a decision that we can make. So that's what we would recommend for this one. When we passed our aquaculture regulations to allow offshore aquaculture, one of the things that we didn't deal with that we do need to now is to recognize that if you're going to have an aquaculture operation, you're going to produce very large quantities of some species of fish, and if you want to bring them to shore and land them, we need to exempt them from our harvest or from our bag and size limits for that reason. That's our climate recreational issue, so we want to make that clear. That's what this would do. There's a group of a crab fishermen that had the opportunity to make use of a product that's thrown away from the catfish farms to work their crab traps, and they have asked for permission to use freshwater catfish heading crab traps, and that's certainly fine with us and law enforcement folks there. It's fine, and we need to pass that as a rule to allow them to do that. So we're good with that. That's mostly, I went down and took a look at some of it. I understand what they're talking about, but as long as they have to load the catfish heads in and I don't, that's good. Yeah. And then a cleanup a little bit to create some consistency between statutory languages. In the statute, we use coastal boundaries. In the proclamations, we use salt water. We need to make sure they're the same so that it's clear, and use coastal waters to define what define our borders. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, that's our proposals for tomorrow. And certainly, ask any questions, we're glad to answer those. And with question you consider moving this forward tomorrow for the agenda.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, discussion? Okay, if there are no further questions or discussion, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Yeah. Thank you. Sir, excuse me.
Okay. We'll get assessed tomorrow, but
I'm going to sit tomorrow and talk about those counties, but certainly it
didn't. No, I'll read it.
Sir, Chair, the only other thing we would like to clarify from you is if you are in favor of us going forward and granting the executive director that authority, we would need to publish that in the register and go through that rulemaking, and we would ask for your permission to do that.
Right. Come back in May.
Thoughts on that, anyone? Okay, that's good. Yes. Thank you. All right, before we conclude, when we were discussing item 4, I believe. Item 3, committee item 3, at the suggestion of Commissioner Parker, we allowed Dr. Fitzgerald to come up and speak, and there's another gentleman who's been waiting and who was referenced by you, John, and you're welcome to come up and speak for a few minutes if you like.
Thank you, sir. I deeply appreciate the opportunity. I'm sorry I wouldn't be able to be here tomorrow, but I would be a little remiss to hear one side of the story without giving you another perspective to think about. My name is Bob Popowell. I was in Parks and Wildlife Magazine this month. It's Bayou Bob. I've been in the turtle and snake and reptile business for over 40 years. And, you know,
my perspective is that during the course of a season, I deal with hundreds and hundreds of landowners and hundreds of people who have jobs created from this non-game collection process. I was doing it long before the reports were required, and I have a field practitioner's experience that spans 40 years. It's pretty extensive. And really, I'll say some surprising things. I came to a meeting here in November, late November, I'll be the 27th, the first and only meeting we had on this process, and it was very rewarding. But, you know, we're clearly in support of sustaining the population. We're in business and have been for a long time. That would be foolhardy and short-sighted not to do that. The proposal that I heard today, I really don't have a problem. I mean, the box turtle market is not important. The worst enemy of the box turtle is traffic on the highways. The worst enemy to the diamondback terrapin is the purse seines and draw seines and the crab traps, which y'all are taking up, the unattended ones. That's where the turtles were drowning and dying. What I'm really interested in expressing, and y'all have already recognized it, and that is, long ago you recognized private property owners' rights who had to stock tanks and lakes. You've left them alone as far as regulations for fish. If a landowner pays for a bulldozer service to put a lake in the middle of their pond, their land, they've been unregulated and largely left alone. Turtles are somewhat different because they do migrate, but look back at 60 years, just 60 years. Most of your large lake impoundments started coming online in the early 40s. The biggest lake in the state came online in 69, Toledo Bend. By the way, I recognize most of that water's in Louisiana, but turtles have never known a state boundary at all. But just the top five lakes in Texas kicks you close to 1 million surface acres of water that wasn't there 60 years ago. Canyon Lake came on in, what, 64, 69? I'm saying that there's millions of acres of public lands that have public waters. There's state parks. There are subdivision lakes. There are municipal and county drainage and water improvements. You see them in every city, large lakes and waterfalls and neat things. What I'm supporting is take every rule that's been recommended by your staff and apply it strictly and only to public waters. You don't regulate fishing in private waters. In the absence of doing that, separating out private landowners and their ponds and lakes, the habit that developed before we came along with the market, and you can talk to any of your landowner friends and they'll substantiate this, people shoot turtles by the thousands on a holiday weekend. They're killed across the state of Texas by the thousands. They float wastefully to the bottom as a natural resource is being wasted. I see traps, and I've sold traps to ranchers who simply set that trap underwater to ground all their turtles. Very commonplace. It's a wasted resource. Now that people see this is an economic resource, many landowners equate this to pecans, deer leasing, quail hunting, and other agricultural products. This is a vast renewable resource. There's enough public acreage to never make it non-sustainable. I encourage my members who harvest turtles to leave public waters totally alone. Dr. Wagner circulated one of our training modules here in the office, and it implores people to stay away from public water because we consider that our recharge zone. We acknowledge that. But I had no authority to tell our turtles not to do that. They're independent individuals. I strongly support a moratorium on public waters. Then I don't have to tell these people, don't go to public waters. But here's the facts. In public waters, there are millions and millions of turtles, but they're almost impossible to trap. And there's many reasons for it. That's what's in our training program. The people who are dead set on harvesting in public waters, they learn very quickly that this is a fact of life, and they quit doing it immediately. Where do they go? Back to private stock tanks, where in a closed environment, a closed ecology, the turtles are predominant. They are targets of opportunity on feeding. All of them are. Snappers, soft shells, red ears, mud turtles, musk, they all are. They come to a baited trap in private water because they have eliminated much of the normal food supply. That's why you see the turtles migrating from these ponds in May and October. The last 2 months where there's water coming in October, they migrate. They've eaten all the food. By having a rule that says you cannot turtle in public water, it makes our role much better. It does not affect the private property rights of individuals to determine who's in their lake. Surely you don't regulate the fish, but they're going to regulate the turtles. They don't want them there. There's never been a rancher that I know of in the state history of Texas who built a lake and ordered turtles from me to restock their bass pond with turtles. Yet the ponds are all full of turtles. And the ranchers and landowners were literally hell bent for leather to eradicate the turtles. The article that came out in Parks and Wildlife had an unusual result. My phone has been ringing off the wall with landowners who are saying, finally, finally, we know how to get rid of our turtles. Can you send someone out here to do it? It's a reflection of the fact that they want them gone. Again, the sustainable population is readily available in public waters, millions of acres. There are millions of acres of habitat, not just the surface water, created in Texas over that same 60-year period that weren't here 60 years ago. That turtle population is huge in private waters. And it would have no implication, in my opinion, to harvest private waters and leave a constant recharge zone for sustainability in these massive number of acres of public water. Everybody's job is simple, and if private landowners are left out of the package that I saw, there's not a turtle in our program who would object to that, because their income, their part-time jobs, as well as the landowners who get a resource and sell it, are not affected by those rules whatsoever. And the sustainability of the turtle population, therefore, is probably not affected at all. I deeply appreciate it. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
What's the market price of various some variety of turtles done in the last 5 years? What do you think it's going to do over the next 5 years?
I appreciate that question, because I heard some misnomers, and I don't think there's any intent of anybody, but I live in this market. I just got back from China, and I can tell you that the red ear market is an unsustained market here. It's not true that red ears are a future market for us. Every season, by mid-July, my customers, the ones in China, don't want any red ears. I heard the zoo biologist at Fort Worth on the news, and I've been making the news everywhere up in that area. They're driving me crazy. But I'm hearing him make statements that are absolutely false. He said that everybody's after these ragged females, the big females that are adults full of eggs. I can't give those away, gentlemen. Nobody wants them. And the reason for that is, over the past 40 years, variously, I have sold turtles to China, among other countries. When I was over there, the turtles that I sent, among other dealers across the country, they're very industrious people. They raised 23 million hatchling red ears off of the turtles that the cumulative group of us had fostered to them over the years. Very soon, they're going to have huge snapper populations. I saw the babies. I saw the hatching process. They have the soft shells are giving a little trouble. They're not adapting as well as the others. But the Chinese people will very soon be, like I heard one of the board members say, I think it was Dr. Wagner, Louisiana is more interested in sustaining and enriching your gene pool. That's why they want some of our turtles. The Chinese will reach that point at some point, except possibly for soft shell turtles.
The question was, what's the market price for turtles in for the last 5 years? What's it going to be for the next 5 years?
I have paid 20 cents a pound for turtles in Texas all along. I've been quoted at all of the prices. We pay 20 cents a pound now. We've paid it for years and years. They're called junk turtles only in that there's a huge supply of them and no demand. They sell overseas for about a dollar at best, a piece, not per pound. So 20 cents a pound sometimes they cost me to send them. They're not a profit margin, but if these customers in my contracts did not take red ears, they do it because they also include snappers and soft shells, which are highly desirable. Snappers and soft shells are considered money turtles. They're expensive. Right now, we're paying a dollar a pound plus 40 cents a pound bonus through the month of May. More of that is to get some of the old turtlers who are semi-retired to start doing it again because the money is better. I'm licensed in, I have been at various times in Florida, Louisiana, certainly Oklahoma. Part of the problem here is that we're getting raped by other states. And I told at that meeting, I said, I am all for this commission exorbitantly raising dealer costs for the license. That's me. I'm all for them astronomically raising out-of-state fees for non-residents on these dealer licenses. That's me too, and that I'm over there. It costs me 4 to 5 to 6 times more to go to Louisiana, and it's costing them peanuts to come over here. Many of the turtles that leave Texas illegally, and I know this for a fact, leave here on little country roads across the Red River in Louisiana. There's a huge turtle trade over in East Texas. I'm in a semi-arid place. It's very different. But these turtles leave here in massive numbers, to the tune of, they're not accounted for, but many Louisiana turtle growers are in the process of backing out of red ears altogether.
Prices for turtles over the last 5 years and going forward, what do you think will happen in the next 5 years?
Okay.
We do have to break.
Yeah, we have to break.
They will not increase dramatically, and the reason for that is the Chinese market replacement. The answer to your question is 5 years ago in Guangzhou, China, at the animal market, the line where it said U.S. turtles was a long line. Everybody wanted U.S. turtles. The Chinese line for local turtles was slim and none. It has reversed itself. They now have healthy turtles that are cheaper because of the transportation problem alone, and the transportation cost is one thing, but the depreciation of the quality of the livestock that gets there is also affected by that long travel. Chinese turtles are more desirable and cheaper, and so U.S. turtles are simply seen as a gene pool enrichment, and the price will not go up dramatically at all. It's been the same for 10 years.
Thank you.
We appreciate your
perspective.
Thank you very much.
Chairman, I think we're there.
That's it?
Good
job. Anything else come for the commission today, Bob?
No, sir.
Hearing none, you stand adjourned. See you in the morning.